I've seen vile words painted on walls. They say, Queen of Bastards. The work, I am sure, of some of your misguided subjects who mistakenly believe their queen to be unkind.
Welcome, everybody, to A Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV podcast about the HBO original series House of the Dragon. As usual, I am one of your hosts, Jesse Earl, and it has been several years since I read Fire and Blood, the book upon which House of the Dragon is based, and I am joined, as always, by the one, the only, the amazing author of the unofficial guide to Game of Thrones and my fellow co-host,
Kim Renfro.
Yeah,
that's me. Hi. I'm Kim Renfro, and I've reread Fire and Blood many, many times, including recently,
yes.
Much more recently than Jesse.
And I swear, it's not because I'm lazy, it's because it makes a fun dynamic for this podcast. But speaking of dynamics for this podcast, we are very lucky today because we have what I'm going to call a very special guest, even though he is the one, the only regular co-host of this show, David Chen. Good to have you with us. Yeah.
So good to be here, folks. It's been so awesome to see what you two have been doing with the podcast in my absence. I did just want to explain, you know, I think we talked about it a little bit in our bonus episode before the podcast began the season, that I was in the process of moving back from Portugal to the United States right when House of the Dragon season 3 premiered. And then almost immediately after that, I got very violently ill, which you can hear me when I'm on the other podcasts. Like, I'm talking and I sound terrible. And so it just would have been horrible for me to maintain an additional podcast in addition to all the other podcasts that I was already doing. But literally, this is the first day I've been back that I felt somewhat normal. And so I'm so excited to be here to talk about season 3, episode 4 of House of the Dragon with two experts. It's quite a thrill.
Yeah,
we're so happy to have you.
Woo!
Yeah, we're very, very excited. I know personally I have been wanting to hear your thoughts on this season. We've texted a little bit about it, but I've been like, I want to know what you think, because I know we quite often, I'll text you thoughts on TV shows and movies that I've seen. So it's always nice to discuss with you. And we're both really glad that you're feeling better and that you're back.
Hell yeah. Yay.
Yeah. Well, as David so wonderfully stated, we are going to be talking about season 3, episode 4 today of House of the Dragon, titled Tumbleton, which was written by David Hancock, who wrote two episodes of season 2, including most notably The Red Sewing, which was the penultimate episode of last season. And then this episode was directed by Claire Kilner, who directed numerous episodes, including the last two episodes of the season. So she has definitely been directing this block of episodes this year. But going from that, if you want to support shows like A Cast of Kings, and become a paid subscriber at decodingtv.com to get ad-free episodes of this show, as well as our bonus episodes where we talk about the differences between the show and the book, if you want to get that. Also, as per usual, if you want to give feedback on the podcast or have one of your comments possibly read on it by Kim or myself, please send it to acastofkings@gmail.com. And finally, please consider subscribing to watch video versions of this podcast, as well as the main Decoding TV podcast over at youtube.com/DecodingTV, where you get to see our lovely faces and David Chen's lovely face as well, where you get to see him being returned to the show and all of that fun stuff. And with all of that said, let us jump right into our general spoiler-free thoughts on this show. And I want to give a quick chance to you, David, because you haven't been here for the season so far. What are your overall thoughts on the season as a whole going into this?
Yeah, and I do just want to mention, by the way, because a couple people have asked, it's so great to be here today, and I anticipate I will be able to be back for, one or two more episodes this season, but it is the Jesse and Kim show, and I'm thrilled to watch it / listen to it every week for the season of House of the Dragon. But in terms of this season of House of the Dragon, I have to say the season has been pretty excellent. And in particular, I think the first three episodes were amazing. And not only were they amazing, but they were three very, very different modes of episodes, mm-hmm. right? Episode 1, obviously, this huge battle. Episode 2, obviously, had this incredible climax of a real mixed bag with Rhaenyra taking the throne. And, you know, maybe that... Did she really want that? You know, because it turns out it comes with some trade-offs. And then episode 3 is something that I don't recall ever seeing from the show before, where it's all told from Rhaenyra's perspective. Ramin Djawadi putting in some incredible work in that episode that's like just takes his already excellent work for the show to another level. The claustrophobic perspective, the filmmaking of, hey, we're just following this character's decisions. I don't remember the show being this focused on Allison's decision-making, by the way. But anyway, whatever, we can put that aside. And then episode 4, which I would say this is the most, I think, like, quote-unquote classical Game of Thrones-style episode, where it's people scheming and putting pieces in place for whatever their next gambit is going to be. So we've had 4 episodes, and they're all quite different from each other. And I think that is just really, really impressive. I think the season has been awesome so far. And as I discussed with Patrick Klepek on the main Decoding TV podcast, it's easy for me to imagine an alternate universe where this season 2 ended with episodes 1 and or 2 of this season. And that would have been like, that would have sent people out in such a different mood. You know what I mean? Like, it would have been so triumphal, people coming out of season 2, as opposed to just like, that was it. You know, a lot of people, I think, felt, including myself, felt like, that was it? And that was the end of season 2? Yeah. But they were clearly like, I think, I don't know how conscious they were of this, but I think they, to me, it feels like, all right, season 2 kind of didn't really pay off, like, but we really need to be bringing our A game. And they are doing that with pretty much every episode this season so far. So I've been loving it and really enjoying your analyses as well.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I it's been interesting this season on that note, because I do think, again, this is my conspiracy theory brain, but I do remember reading somewhere at the end of season 2, they lost 2 episodes because it got cut down from 10 to 8. And then the writer's strike happened, so they couldn't change anything of the episodes, or at least as much of the episodes that they wanted to. So I still have the conspiracy theory that episodes 1 and 2 of this season were meant to be the penultimate episodes of last season. It would have been phenomenal.
It would have been so sick. It would have been so sick to end with that, you know? But
Alas, alas. Well, Kim, what did you think of this episode, Tumbleton?
Oh, man, this was big roller coaster of emotions for me. And I think it's funny because now listening to your recap, David Chen, of all 4 episodes, I'm a little less confident on saying this, but I was coming into this convo being like, I think this is my favorite of the season so far, even though it's like a high bar. High bar that they've been setting for that. But I do think that's how I was feeling, maybe because it is this classic mix of everything that I've come to really love in an episode of Game of Thrones, like surprises for me as a book reader, some really cool questions being answered about where certain things have been going, new threads opening up, so much quality dragon time in this episode, and dogs, and a mention of cats. A great episode for animal lovers.
Dogs and cats exist in the Game of Thrones universe.
And rabbits. Don't forget the rabbit at the top of the episode, which was, I watched the behind the scenes. I actually needed to know this. That was a real rabbit they shot. I needed to know.
Wow. it was not a CG rabbit for them.
Anyway, sorry, I had to say that.
No, phenomenal. Adding to the animal lover in me was very satiated with this episode. Yeah, I really think that, as you said, Dave, like, you can tell everyone's working at bringing their A game is exactly what it feels like. And the impact is landing for me, certainly, as a lover of this universe.
I guess not only bring their A game, but also, like, I think taking chances structurally with what a House of the Dragon Game of Thrones episode can be. Like, just trying all kinds of different stuff that is... It's not like it hasn't been done in Game of Thrones before, but it's like, hey, they're taking chances with like focusing on one character for an entire episode. That's very rare, you know? Or this is just epic battle, wall-to-wall battles. That's the whole episode, you know? Like, this is rare, right? So, yeah, I feel like they're really leaving it all in the field, you know, is kind of what I think.
Yeah, and even with the battle episodes, which we have gotten like, the Battle of the Bastards or something like this was all on sea for the most part for episode 1, which is like a unique terrain for Game of Thrones to focus on. So yeah,
absolutely.
I am with you, David, on the overall season. I will say for this episode, for me personally, this was probably my least favorite episode of the season. That by no means says it's a bad episode. I think it's a really, really good one. But it is, as you were saying, a kind of moving pieces into place sort of episode where he's like, all right, this character is getting set up here and it's leading into whatever they're going to do in the latter half of the season, which is always, you know, fun to see the schemes within schemes and things moving around. But I do think it just makes for a little bit of a less, you know, standalone episode like we've been getting the past three episodes. So this is just that sort of more transitional one, but still really, really great. And I think gets us a really fun introduction to a new player who we've seen in previous episodes, but certainly gets forefronted here in this one. And I really liked the very complicated view we get of him in this episode. So a very strong one in my book, probably my least favorite of the season, but again, that's a very high bar, and certainly this episode is still up there with a great episode of Game of Thrones in the Game of Thrones universe, I should say. So yeah, I agree with both of you. Well, one quick thing I did want to touch upon before we dive into the episode itself is I just wanted to bring up this wonderful email from Patrick Spunoggle. Apologies if I said your last name incorrectly. But he wanted to quick comment on our discussion last week. One of our major criticisms was of Daemon not catching that Daeron Targaryen was a plant that was given to him by Ormond. I know Kim and I, we talked about that as one of our big criticisms of the episode. And Patrick says, as a book reader, I'll agree that the scene might have seemed weak, but that's because we have guilty knowledge. To judge the effectiveness of the scene, we have to talk to non-book readers. I can only offer one data point, but I asked my wife if she had been surprised by the twist of the blonde-haired hostage not being the real Targaryen. She confirmed that it was a surprise. Ormond in this episode engages in a level of deception that seems out of bounds for the usual norms. We know from Catelyn Stark's experience in trusting the Freys back in book one that in general, people stick to their words. In most situations, oaths sworn are not broken. Impostors are not substituted for hostages. Daemon, although being a scoundrel, has likely internalized that he's different from the rank and file lords of Westeros who are overly burdened with honor. He had the pressure of the Blackwoods into committing war crimes last season. Ormond seems to be cut from the same cloth as Daemon, but he's more diligent about hiding it. And something that plays into this episode, as we'll see with Ormond. But I wanted to address it because I think this is true. I think us as book readers, without getting into book comparisons necessarily, we had a little bit of more like frustration at that situation. But I will contend that my criticism still holds up because my big issue with it was the fact that Daemon didn't take back the dragon, which is kind of like, oh, I've left my nuclear bomb with my enemy. Didn't take it back. It's like, you can keep that nuclear bomb. I'll take the guy who can push the button, but you keep the bomb. It seems like a bad move.
Yeah, like what happened there? Like, did they just set the dragon free afterward? Like, what was the story that was told at the end there? You know?
Yeah.
Right. It ties into, I think, like we had like threads of a little bit of confusion of like, okay, what are they implying has happened at Tumbleton at the end of last episode? And then it's honestly a little bit in contrast to what we see, like the episode picks up here and it's like, oh, there's not a disaster going on. It's actually like, seems like a very calm, orderly, infiltration of this town. So right, what went awry with the Dragon Keepers? What was going on? I still have questions about that, but I super appreciate Pat bringing in this perspective of what it was like for a non-book reader to actually go through the surprise of that reveal. I think that I can certainly see how that was more effective.
Yeah, did it work for you, David, as a non-book reader?
I'm gonna say mixed, right? So we're talking about the reveal that Daeron, right? It was
was a plant, right? that Ormond
wasn't,
right?
And
this is, it was not in the books, and this is a very controversial change why did they add this? And honestly, I will just confess, have any of you seen the hit 2010 film MacGruber?
I have, one of my favorite movies of all time, actually.
Okay, so there's this scene where they decide to dress Kristen Wiig up as MacGruber. Mm-hmm. And they decided, hey, we're going to put Kristen Wiig dressed as MacGruber into the enemy's den. And that way they'll be distracted by Kristen Wiig dressed as MacGruber while like Will Forte MacGruber, the real MacGruber, he like does the actual thing. And so then they say, and Will Forte is like pitching this plan. MacGruber's pitching this plan. And he's like, yes, and then they won't know that it's me that's going in there. And he's like, but that's only going to fool them for like 5 seconds.
Yeah.
that is exactly the scene that came to mind. And it's a cool moment. Like in the moment I'm watching it, I'm thinking to myself, that's kind of cool that it's a different, but then I'm like, but then literally Rhaenyra asked the question that I had, which is, and did he not think I would find out? Like, I'm like, yeah, what was the broader strategy there exactly?
Yeah.
And it turns out it did fool her for like
2 days,
a day. And I guess that's what they needed. Maybe like that helped them a lot, perhaps. But also, yes, you've already pointed out the inconsistency with like leaving the dragon as well, and so pretty dicey. So I'll say from a filmmaking perspective, cool moment in the show. From an overall storyline plot perspective, I don't think they did enough work to make this be like, oh wow, what a cool moment in the show. So those are, I'm probably more on your side despite not being a book reader at all.
Well, I also want to make sure we had the other perspective. Also, it's just very funny because I think this is, you were talking on another podcast about MacGruber, which is why I watched it. So
I
thought it was great. It was very fun. It's a very funny movie. Yeah.
It is better than the SNL sketches would suggest.
By far. Yeah. So I was really
definitely
impressed.
Worth checking out.
I love that we are becoming MacGruber stands in this show.
As Christopher Nolan intended, that's one of his favorite films. So.
That is true. I think what you brought up. Yeah, that's phenomenal.
Not a joke.
I love that. Well, with all of that said, we're going to jump into our big spoiler-filled discussion of the episode right after this quick break from our sponsors. And we are back with A Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV podcast. Before we get into the episode proper, I just want to let you all know that we are going to be talking full spoilers about the episode from here on out, but will not spoil anything from the book. But if you do want our thoughts about comparing the book to the show, as I mentioned before, we are doing weekly bonus episodes over on the DecodingTV.com feed. So please check out over there and become a paid subscriber if you want those episodes. That being said, let us jump into this episode with Kim's wonderful breakdown. So this week's episode opens with a quietish morning in Tumbleton as Lord Ormond Hightower's army makes itself at home in the market town. And by makes itself at home, we mean soldiers barging into homes in assigned groups of two or three. One batch of these goons forces their way into Cat's brother's house, setting a deadly series of events in motion, as we see later on in the episode. Kim, what'd you think of this opening?
My roller coaster of emotions started so fast in this episode. I paused the episode about 2 minutes in, right before we see the soldiers go into this house, kind of taking note of like, oh, I think that they're setting up. It felt to me like I was about to get like a hard home experience. You guys remember back in Game of Thrones season 5? Book readers got really caught off guard with how like there was almost this entirely contained storyline episode at an unusual point in the season. And all that we knew is that it was titled Hard Home, I think. And this was one of the rare times that I started watching an episode of this season of House of the Dragon and I knew the episode title going in. They've been doing the thing where they like don't show it when you first open HBO Max. I think as if it's like potentially spoilery or as if like knowing the theme of the episode might be too much. This was a time where it said Tumbleton and I just, something about Ramin Djawadi's score right away, even in like the recap, I was fully set up to be like, I think something really cool and terrible is going to happen in this episode of television. And I think that paid off, but not quite in the way that I thought it was going to. And so certainly this opening scene and focusing in on Kat, who people might not even realize that her name is Kat. Kat is the woman who is sort of at the center of this Tumbleton drama in this episode. And she is Hugh Hammer's wife. And she, her and Hugh's child, their daughter, died in Flea Bottom prior to him going and claiming Vermithor the dragon. And
that was so a big storyline last season.
Yeah. And so she has now been like living in this town, presumably to try to escape the war. And the fact that the war comes straight to her front door, let alone in such a terrible, visceral way. Was just like, again, set me on a roller coaster straight away. I also had like, I had a terrible feeling I knew exactly where this was going as soon as that soldier made the comment about like, oh, maybe it's not so bad. It's crowded in here. And I was pretty, I'm pretty disappointed how right I was. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, it was fairly obvious where it was going to head. It's like, oh no, I can see the writing on the wall. David, what do you think of this opening sequence with everything in Tumbleton?
I'll just say I'm so grateful to have such a vivid illustration of why the Third Amendment is necessary.
I was thinking that too. Like,
it's
do not.
It's not one of the more popular ones. You always hear about the first and the second and the fifth, but the third one, it should be right up there. So
yeah. That was dead ass what popped into my mind too when I saw this. Well, I was like, oh, we're doing a big Third Amendment episode? wow.
Cool. Not political at all. You gotta remember all of your rights, folks. Yeah. One other thing, too, I just wanted to know. I listened to all the behind-the-scenes stuff before we watched the episode, and two things that was interesting here, besides the fact that the rabbit was actually there and I needed to know, but they very specifically used different colors for Tumbleton. They used harvest colors, was a very intentional choice by Claire Kilner to code everything in Tumbleton, which I really liked, and the visual look of it was really unique. And then also this opening sequence was very much, in her mind, modeled after the Nazis coming into France during World War II and sort of occupying the town. So I think it definitely evoked those very similar feelings as well. So just an interesting little bit of the behind the scenes and thought process of these sequences. But as we keep going, we get a closer glimpse at the real Ormond Hightower as he dismisses Lord and Lady Footley from their own bedchambers after revealing his false promise of loyalty to Queen Rhaenyra. So, David, what do you think of this section here?
Yeah, it was good. I was surprised Daemon didn't fry his ass for being reluctant about it. And of course, now we know that, you know, there was some heavy deception. Like, I'm surprised, given how things played out, that he wasn't more deferential. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
He should really rethink his strategy there, is what I have to say about that.
I did like this, the lady, Footley, her being like, yeah, we support Queen Rhaenyra. I was like, oh, God, very foreign. You see the husband being like, maybe calm down, honey. but again, you get Ormond, like, being this. What I liked is how we portray him as he speaks to Darren later on, like, you need to be firm but fair of like, okay, I'm going to be, you know, very thoughtful as a character and, you know, I will try and be fair and not overly cruel with these folks, which makes him seem reasonable at first. And it's an interesting characterization for him, especially as you go further in the episode. So I liked this sort of like thing with him. I also really loved, as we sort of get throughout the episode, the sense of like his prissiness. He's like, he's cleaning himself in his bath and I need to like be clean. And also we get like the whole smell thing, as we got hinted at in previous episodes that Rhaenyra learns too later on. It's like, oh well, he's a pretty little rich boy, which I kind of found fascinating.
Well, so there is this how do I put this extremely bluntly and not necessarily super accurately? There is a kind of politics of who is allowed to see who naked.
Yes.
Like, if you look at like rich people's mansions from England, old England or what have you, right? Like, there's a lot of like, their baths are in the middle of the space while like other people tend to them. And it's very, not performative, but it's very like they're on display.
Yes.
And so it's like, who is allowed to show who's junk? It dictates who has the power in that situation.
And it also ties into something that Ormond said too, of like the people beneath you, you have to be firm but fair. And so there's this direct sense of like hierarchy and things like that, that Ormond has very much ingrained in himself and teaching to Darren. But Kim, I wanted to make sure you get a chance to speak on this section too.
Yeah, I mean, I was coming off the scene of the soldier making what felt to me like a clear threat. It was, you know, like Chekhov's rape was on the wall, and I was like sitting here waiting for the other shoe to drop. And to go straight from that into the scene with Ormond, which, yes, was like James Norton, I believe is the name of this actor. I recognized him from Little Women. Totally different vibe going on in that movie.
Yeah, very much so.
But that he has this like charm and like reassurance to him while he is also doing things that are like incredibly, yes, like abusive and aimed at making the people around him feel small and powerless underneath his decisions. And so, yeah, the contradiction that we're constantly seeing between what Ormond says he is doing in all of these interactions versus what he is actually doing, it was very stark. But yes, I was very drawn in right away to the dynamic that's happening here. Because again, like we've seen Ormond in the past episodes, you know, all dressed up and in front of his army and kind of in official capacity. So to see sort of like the real man behind the scenes here was fascinating. And then, you know, of course we go straight into seeing Daron. And similarly, like, I just thought that like all of the performances from these men were so finely tuned into being very like both like reactive off of one another and bringing in these, again, like these like contradictions and like paradoxes between how the Hightowers see themselves, especially in contrast to the Targaryens versus like the actual, you know, savagery or crudeness that they engage in, just in a more duplicitous way.
Yeah, I did really like us getting to see Darren here as well. I want to save a little bit more discussion about him for a little bit later on, because like, there'll be a good moment to talk about that slightly later. But one actor, too, that you noted here in the notes that I also noted was John Roxton, who is an actor played by actor Joplin Sibtain. And he was in the background of a couple previous episodes. And I kept being like, why do I recognize him? I just kept seeing him over and over again. And I finally looked it up. He's Brasso in Star Wars Andor, if anyone watches that show. And I was like, that's who he is. Great actor, great part in that show. But do you want to quick, Kim, just give us a little background on this guy without going, we'll talk more about his role in the books in our bonus episode, but just want to get a quick explanation of who this mostly silent guy is in these scenes.
Yeah, I mean, he's like a really steadfast ally to the Hightowers throughout this conflict, as you can see. And I really, again, like the setup that they have between Roxton is very deferential to Darren, like calls him my prince, like is very acknowledging that like on some level, Darren is the higher authority, or like is from the most noble trough. Is that the word that came up last time?
I love trough is just a word to use.
I think that the way that John Roxton tends to like basically enable all of Ormond's worst instincts here, and kind of almost like he's like the normalizer, I feel like, of this situation in a way. And Darren is very much like the young, scared, like child in the dynamic of trying to manage wartime in Westeros while being the fourth son is not an easy task that Darren got saddled with there. And this scene was also making me, I was also thinking in this, as we're introduced to him again, like the red hair. I'm again left a little bit confused here as to whether or not Darren truly has the silver hair of a Targaryen, possibly because I was very drawn to this portrait that we get of Darren in this episode where he seems so similar to Alicent. And I was like, I believe that he is her like more auburn haired child, but yet I'm like, no, maybe this is like double layers of symbolism that I'm getting here.
No, I think he was meant to deceive Rhaenyra. There's no way Alicent would not recognize her own kid, right? So like, yeah, it doesn't matter what his hair is at this point. As for his natural, Daron's natural hair, you know, your guess is as good as mine, but it seems authentic to me what we see in the episode.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking as well. Yeah,
but yeah, I think. It's interesting that they held back showing Darren until this point in the show, right? Because like they've mentioned him and then they only show him now. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of, like she does remark that he's her most he's her like favorite kid because he's not a terrible person, although who knows how long that's gonna last.
Yes, so. Yeah. As we get and I'll just to jump ahead to that scene, we can jump back a second ago, but we have Rhaenyra goes to the Godswood to get more information from Alicent about Ormond and Darren. She says, Lord Ormond considered himself a scholar when they were younger, collecting tapestries and writing songs while despising the ignorant and uncouth. Very classic Hightower hoity-toityness and sense of superiority. But the most telling details we receive are that Gawain once thought Ormond was cruel, and Alicent believes him to be acting as Darren's father figure. And we also get a little reference here where Rhaenyra learns of Ormond's affinity for aversion to smells, which is a sort of common trait we see him displaying throughout this episode and previous ones. But yeah, I really liked this sequence because, again, I like this moment where Alicent and Rhaenyra are having these great discussions between the two of them and kind of going into, again, Rhaenyra kind of having an advisor with Alicent and kind of trusting on that friendship a little bit more, but obviously that tension occurring between the two of them and connecting over motherhood. As we know, it's not overtly said, but Rhaenyra sent her own children away across the sea, and Alicent also having done the same, and this great discussion with Alicent about, you know, I wanted to try and protect my kids, protect my one kid after seeing everything that happened with my other children who turned out to be giant jerks. And so this interesting discussion there, but then also with Ormond, again, as we'll later see, also being a very cruel figure, as Gawain noted himself, and how that also might have affected his upbringing and how that affected Darren growing up, as we'll talk about in a moment. But any thoughts on this quick little scene? We can jump back to the previous one, but since we were kind of on it here.
Yeah, I mean, I love that Rhaenyra asks the question, like, did it pain you to have to send your child away? I think that in that moment, Rhaenyra is being kind of impatient with Alicent up until that point. And then that's when, like, they sort of settle into, like, oh, we're going to have, like, an actual connected conversation. But I, like, Alicent doesn't really answer the question because she just says, it was my choice. So, like, she corrects the idea that she had to send him away, but she doesn't acknowledge whether it was painful or not. But presumably, yes, of course, like, how could it not be? And, yeah, the way that, particularly in this scene, Alicent is, we get a close-up of her picking at her skin again. You can tell that the subject, and that just the state of her life at the moment is kind of bringing up these anxieties that we saw her experience really heavily when she was a kid. Back when, I remember it was like around the episode when Otto is effectively sending her to be Viserys's future bride. You know, she's picking at her skin a lot, and he like tries to, you know, tamp it down, which again feels to me like we're getting this picture of the Hightowers, and this specific way that they try to present cleanliness or dignity or outward appearances, but that it's incredibly surface level, that they're not very worried about, like, this sort of internal rot that might be going on underneath. And instead, there's a lot of projection going on towards the Targaryens in that realm, which might be fair in some ways. You know, I'm not here to say that Targaryens are not without their
own foibles.
Exactly.
Well, one of the things that it does remind me of, and it'll become a textual conversation a little bit later, is the religious aspect of the Hightowers that gets brought up in this episode, of how tied they are to religion. And I always think of, when we think of very heavily religious households and families, how much they repress without getting too deeply into it. I remember my family was Roman Catholic, and there's a lot of, like, oh, don't talk about these subjects. Don't talk about, like, you know, sex or any of these things. We don't discuss it. It's very taboo. And a similar thing here of, like, oh, if you're self-harming, just shove it down, bury it down. Don't talk about it. And as we see with Ormond too, later on, not well-handled ways and healthy ways to handle violence and aggression coming out in very, very terrible ways, especially if you are seen as a privileged person who's allowed to do that to other people. So I like that as sort of, like, not overt, but undercurrent sort of tie into these characters of the religious sort of, like, tamping down aspect of their family. Well, jumping back a little bit, meanwhile, a few scenes earlier, Ormond had successfully gotten into Rhaenyra's head. She's ruminating in the small council chamber over what games he's playing. Missaria and Orwyle look concerned as Rhaenyra says maybe he's luring her into burning down the town, so people will call her Maegor Returned. But they're all debating on limited information. Perhaps Ormond himself is the only one who knows the whole truth of his seditious plot to raise Darren to the Iron Throne. So, David, any thoughts on this sequence?
I think that the show is doing a great job of, number one, illustrating how difficult it is to rule, and number two, how difficult it is to conduct warfare when all you have are humans and the equivalent of nuclear weapons and nothing in between.
Yes. Yeah, very much so, yeah.
Right? So it's like, they can do the dragons, but that'll just torch everyone and destroy, but, or they can send people in and a lot of people will die, but nothing in between. They basically... Yeah. And so it's a challenge, and I like that the show is illuminating that.
Kim, anything to say here?
What I love about this episode and last week's is that it makes me, like, Google words. Like, I love when I have to, like, double check that I understand the definition of words. I love when Game of Thrones, you know, enhances my vocabulary. Rondel was the one that got me in this one, where I was like, Rhaenyra says, like, he might as well have put a big rondel on his chest. And I was like, in my mind, I was like, okay, that means, like, target or something. But I went to go look it up. And I believe, in fact, the what she's referring to as like a specific type of game wheel. And so this was just one of many times in the episode where this, the, you know, the literal symbolism of a Game of Thrones happening was coming up again. And I like the way that the show is laying out how Rhaenyra has such limited information, in part because she's so behind on, right, like having a small council, on making up for the losses that she's accrued, especially over, like, it's been a pretty short period of time that a lot of stuff has gone down. I think it's only been a matter of like a few weeks that most of the events of season two and now season three have unfolded. And yeah, you know, we get a lot of meditation on whether, you know, the person with the sword wields the most power, the person with a crown on their head wields the most power. Like, these themes have been present all throughout Game of Thrones and now these spinoff shows. And this was an episode where I was like, oh, information is power here. Who knows the truth of what is going on? And who knows which plots are afoot is the only way to have the upper hand. And unfortunately, Rhaenyra is... she's in the dark about a lot of stuff. And that's, I think, like, Ormond, I was kind of trying to track what Ormond's plot is. And I think part of the reason why Rhaenyra is so lost is because Ormond also seems to be kind of improvising a lot, despite having this air of like, I'm in complete control and this was the plot all along. But I think that, yes, we're seeing how swirly Rhaenyra can get when she doesn't actually know what's going on and she's questioning who to trust and she doesn't have a ton of trustworthy people around her. So I thought Orwell was like legend in this whole episode. I think that he continues to play the game, for lack of a better word, very well. He seems to actually like genuinely want to help and do the right thing for the most amount of people. And then watching Missarya also try to balance Rhaenyra's need for like reassurance on her legitimacy with guiding her into like not neglecting the small folk was also very well done, I think, in this episode.
Yeah, I did really like that element where we have Missarya saying like, well, hire a master of coin and then we can blame him. He can be the one thrown under the bus during this sequence, which I think is a very politically astute move of like, all right, we can kind of play the game here and, you know, get someone in because we need to spread out the small council, but also we can sort of have someone that we can treat as a little bit disposable. So we get Manderly, I believe was his name, coming in. So I like Missarya being very smart here, but Rhaenyra is, and we get this focus later on too, is kind of focused on how people view her, being like, if I go there and burn the town, and it's politically astute on her part where if she burns it down, people will judge her as well. But she's also focused on appearances where, you know, Orwell, who she invites to be on the council again, who poor guy, he's just doing his best. And I appreciate that. He goes to try and grab the little orbs that they used to place on their sort of like decorative, like, oh, we're here on the council, this is who's here. She's mm-hmm. like, oh, this is part of the old regime. And it's like, not a necessary, like, it's just a performative thing that she's sort of doing away with to sort of, we're doing something new, rather than anything substantive, which is kind of a lot of what Rhaenyra is focused on in this season so far, of like legitimacy and how she is perceived versus how people have perceived the old guard. So I like that as like a small example of what she's more focused on rather than a lot of the other things going on.
But also, it explains how the small council was like that in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, true.
They're not using
yeah.
those little rock things, those spherical rock things, and it's like we're watching the origin story of whatever exactly. The anti-origin story, like the opposite of origin story is.
Yeah.
Here's why they don't do that in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I no, it was very very nice yeah. and like seeing like little ways of which these things affect through time. Of
right.
like Rhaenyra did affect some she got yes. rid of the orbs.
Oh, you know? Got rid of the orbs. That was the biggest contribution that she made. She was the Veep of... Westeros. Basically.
Yeah, yeah, I love it. I love it. God, what a good comparison there. Oh God. Well, moving on, we have Alan is sent to retrieve his father, while Lord Corlys Velaryon and Hand of the Queen to Rhaenyra's small council chambers. But Corlys is heading out of the city, clearly no longer to amicably advise Rhaenyra interpersonally. He tells Alan to go in his place. And then to sort of jump to it later, we get a nice little scene where Alan goes to talk to Rhaenyra, and they have a really good bonding moment over Viserys's model and her sort of talking about her father and how he struggled with ruling and how he was also sort of, you know, fathers can frustrate people while also being very helpful at the same time. And I liked this bonding moment between the two of them and Alan proving his worth to Rhaenyra as well, by even suggesting something as small as the cats as a way to get rid of the rats, which was very nice. And again, proving like he's a smart guy who thinks outside the box of the normal small council that we get and the high lords that we normally get in this world. So I like that as well. Any thoughts on these sort of sequences with Alan and Lord Corlys, the two of you?
I'll just say that Corlys is a little bit out of pocket.
He spoke
in a way that I felt like needed some kind of
further justification,
retribution. Mm. If you're the queen, you can't allow someone to speak to you like that, yeah, in a public place without it blowing back on you somehow. So didn't love that.
Yeah.
It's nice that I think Alan being in his place, going in this place, I hope that allows for some middle ground between Rhaenyra just disrespecting his children and her fully accepting them and giving them the honor that they supposedly deserve. So
yeah. No, it's been echoing in my head that the loudness with which Corlys made his feelings heard would surely have consequences. And I think that even though we saw Rhaenyra shy away from holding him accountable for any of those words at the time, I think that that's what the Queen of the Bastards graffiti in this episode is meant to be, like potentially the trickle down effect of Corlys having brought up bastardry so loudly in the castle. And then I think it's super interesting that Ulf, and again, we can get a little bit more into this later once we talk about Ulf, but then the, like Ulf kind of picks up that thread and pulls it in a terrible direction. By mistake, you know, I don't think Ulf realizes that that conversation is what's at the forefront here. He might be thinking of himself and Hugh as the bastards that are being referred to, as if like they are unimportant. And so certainly I think that Corlys like is still operating from a place of like a little bit too much impunity with the way that he's treating his relationship with Rhaenyra. And yet I understand the frustration. But I think out of pocket is a good summary of that. And I was also like, these scenes without Rhaenyra throughout this episode were reminding me a lot of what I think is one of her blind spots, of like a bit of classism, mm-hmm, and how she can become condescending when she starts speaking to people who aren't her immediate royal family, even other lords and ladies, you know, and that she is so warm when she hears it's Alan. Like she says like, oh, come in right away. And again, there's a bit of a contradiction sometimes between her like warmth and niceness and then what she's willing to actually put behind that when it comes to raising people up or giving them the time that they might need in order to like really become steadfast allies. And instead, you know, she focuses on Orwell at the start of this episode as saying, if he continues to be useful and loyal to her, he can maintain her position. And I'm like, I think at the end of the day, as soon as you're mostly judging people by their usefulness to you and loyalty, you're losing the thread a bit about how to actually maintain a coherent ruling system.
And to actually see people as people as well, which speaks to her. We got a little bit of a sense of it last episode with her and Daemon, of like, we are gods. It's always been a thing with Targaryens. And Rhaenyra are trying to focus on the little people in the small folk of King's Landing, but still sort of having this sense of superiority, especially above the other lords in her direct contact, which is very fascinating to see. And speaking of people not getting the small folk, we have a couple scenes here in this episode focused on Aegon and Laerys, our lovely sort of interestingly comedic double-hander that we've been getting with these two this season that I really enjoy. But they finally make their way to Rook's Rest, where they find Sunfire surrounded by felled trees. Aegon quickly decides that Sunfire is actually alive, but the dragon makes no movement. And we have a little sequence where Laerys tries to fend off some curious onlookers who maybe want to rob them. But they get brought to a group of soldier riffraff who have taken control of the castle ruins. And by the end of this episode, Aegon is humbled after being told to be sort of the latrine cleaner and certainly not wanting to do it and not willing to be doing this things that are beneath him. And sort of going up to the Lord of Rook's Rest, quote unquote Lord, the person who's sort of in charge of it, and demanding he be treated as the king that he believes himself to be, but is forced to kiss the boots, the very nasty looking, let's just say probably filled with dirt and fecal matter boots of this guy. It was very gross, and I'm glad we didn't linger too long on it because it kind of cut away pretty quickly. But it was a great little sequence for these two. I'm curious, David, what do you think of these sequences with Aegon?
Yeah, I'm really enjoying these sequences. I think Laerys is playing it super smart, which mm-hmm. is kind of what you'd expect. My wife has this phrase that she likes to say, which is, so-and-so misread the balance of power.
Yes, yes.
And like someone does something dumbass, and then it's like, well, they misread the balance of power in that
situation.
Just
like The Rock with Black Adam, you know, he misjudged the hierarchy of power of the DC universe.
That is so true. Yes. Aegon is the Rock of, is the Black Adam of Westeros. But yeah, I mean, it's tough. You know, one day you're being crowned in front of all the people with dragons behind you. The next day you're licking fecal matter off of some guy's boot, right? Yeah. In some middle of nowhere, you might die penniless and anonymous. It's a tough come down. So I have a lot of sympathy for Aegon only in this one dimension,
yeah.
Which is that it is hard to adapt to such a dramatic life change. And he's doing a very bad job of it. But yeah, it's cool to watch because, hey, you love seeing the high and mighty brought low, you know?
It's giving me shades of Jaime Lannister a little bit. Certainly Jaime Lannister was a bit more of an honorable character than Aegon ever really was. But it is a similar arc of like, oh, this guy's getting humbled in ways that he wasn't before. He's kind of more like a Joffrey getting a Jaime Lannister arc, which is kind of what I get shades of in this sequence. Mm-hmm. But Kim, I know you have had a lot of thoughts about Sunfire. We'll talk a little bit more about this in the bonus episode in terms of how it relates to the book, but what are your thoughts on Sunfire here and this little sequence where he's alive?
He's alive.
We don't get any sight of that.
Yeah, this is where my little narrow slice of empathy opens up for Aegon, because I'm like, let him be with his dead, dying, potentially hibernating dragon.
He's using both hands. It's two touches.
That was so funny.
That was very good.
This to me was very satisfying payoff for my question of why they kept throwing in these, what felt to me like unnecessary mentions of Sunfire being very dead and very decaying. And I was like, why are we going out of our way to remind us of this? And I was like, oh, okay. I suppose it's because we are getting this pretty intimate, like, emotional moment just between Aegon and Sunfire. It's also the first time that, like, we've really seen one of these characters be able to, like, sit with their dead dragon. I think almost all of the other deaths, it's like, the rider dies either shortly before or shortly after the dragon dies. So the impact of that was really impressive. I also like loved that it's pretty convenience, not the word, but it's like, I felt like we really got to be close up and see a lot of incredible detail of these dragons because Sunfire was able to just be still. And I know that the challenge with CGI and moving things is often that you have to make it look realistic as they're interacting with everything else. So I loved getting like this tragic but like up close version of the dragon. And how, I don't know if you noticed, Aegon like took one of Sunfire's scales with him.
Oh, I didn't catch
when they
that.
Had to leave.
Yeah, that's actually kinda, really like, sweet.
Looking at it in his hand and then like tucked it into his shirt before they headed back to the castle. And I, for one, believe Aegon. Like, I was like, again, I was understanding the dynamics going on where Laris was like, this is not the time for you to like wax poetic in High Valyrian in front of people who are not supposed to know that you are anything but, you know, a humble traveler. But I was very much like, no, let's sit and stay in this moment. Where are we going with this? And so I'm curious to see how they pick that thread up. And also like the contrast, I think, between Sunfire's body and obviously his head is still intact. And then when we saw Melly's, the corpse of Rhaenys's dragon just draped over the wall of that castle wall,
that
like cool headless.
Scene. That was a cool visual too.
It was a really cool shot. And again, I think an important reminder to us of how, I think it was a mistake of Team Green to cut off that dragon head and parade it through the city the way that they did. And clearly it's like this mess is still, it's a very symbolic mess that Team Green left behind, so to say. Yeah.
It reminds me, just one thing to note, is that in the behind the scenes, something they constantly talk about is their big rule for dragons is they have to feel like they exist in the space as well as have their own personality. So I did like the sequence with Sunfire, and then also in a later sequence that we'll get with, Daemon and Sheepstealer, as well in Craxes, about how they really take a lot of time to make sure, like, how would this dragon sit here, even in the sequence where Sunfire is dead or dying, and we really get a sense of the physicality of it. Like, I even think there's some shots where we see the whole dragon and there's flies around it, is like decaying body. And again, this sense of like tactile body to the dragons in a way that we normally wouldn't get with CGI creatures is something I really like this show doing, of really feeling like they are present in a space along with like flies and humans and things like that. So really good job on the production team, as they generally do with this show. But to talk about those later scenes with our dragons that we are going to get in just a minute, we are going to talk about that just after our sponsors. Alrighty, we are back. This is, of course, A Cast of Kings, a Decoding TV podcast. I just want a quick note again. If you want to support the show, please consider becoming a paid subscriber over at Decoding TV, where you can get ad-free episodes of the show, as well as our bonus episodes. But just wanted to give a moment to Kim and David. Where can people find you this week, David? Anything you're doing outside of Cast of Kings?
No, just check out the main flagship Decoding TV podcast. We're going to be talking about The Agency, the Paramount Plus show, and also, we're doing a rewatch of Dark Matter Season 1 in the lead up to Dark Matter Season 2, which is premiering at the end of August on Apple TV. And it's a lot of fun so far. So check it out at Decoding TV, wherever your podcasts can be found.
Yeah, check that. And Kim, where can people find you on social media and such?
Yeah, you could find me on Instagram. I'm at @Mick_Renfro. Mick is just M-I-K. It's Kim backwards.
Yeah. And you can find me at Jesse Gender on YouTube and all the social medias if you want to see what else I am doing. But let us jump back into our recap of the episode. We have a scene here with Sir Criston Cole and Gwaine Hightower finally arriving to Harrenhal, summoned by the signal of Aemon flying overhead several days prior. But they find the castle empty, save for Alice Rivers, the witch and maester of sorts, who was last seen standing over Aemond as he begged for help. Criston and Gwaine argue night to night about what to do at this crossroads, and also Alice Rivers says that Aemond is no longer there, which we are certainly made to question as the audience, even though Criston and Gwaine sort of take it at face value. I really just want to know, I loved how creepy they made Harrenhal. Very creepy sort of sounds going on here. I always love it when we get into the horror aspect of Game of Thrones, and this did a really nice job of it, especially with this location we've seen numerous times in the show. And then Alice Rivers being this very questionable figure, and Criston, and I liked Gwaine here, sort of in contrast to Ormond, as we get throughout this episode, as we'll jump back to in a minute, sort of having this noble, like, we should go meet up with him. It's the right thing to do. This is our job as people. And Criston being like, nope, I'm going to, I, again, a class discussion here of like, I have nowhere to go back to. I've always been the sort of lowborn guy. So you people can like end this war and you know you'll be fine overall. But I, if Rhaenyra wins this, I'm screwed. So I'm going to try and stay here, make a name for myself, and sort of prevent people from coming up. So really fun sort of stuff here. But Kim, what did you think of this sequence?
I loved all of these entry shots as they made their way into Harrenhal were really cool. Also was reminding me that Aemon basically came in and undid all of the rebuilding work that we watched going on around Daemon for like the entirety of season two. So I'm sure upon a rewatch, you'll be extra happy, David Chen, that all that time was spent at
Harrenhal. Yeah. Time well spent.
Time well spent. But, you know, it gets at the sort of the cycle of it all. And this was another scene where I was really seeing these themes come through a new pair of characters to be debating about this Game of Thrones and how you win or you die. Gwaine, in this case, is saying the game is played and it's lost. So, you know, he does indeed seem to kind of want to try to get back to his feather bed and a regular sort of order to life. And what Kristen is pointing out is that the order of life that exists for a majority of people in Westeros under this wheel of successors is that they're all getting crushed and no one is actually looking out for their interests. And so, you know, Kristen, I'm glad that this character has sort of taken on this more like disillusioned, nihilistic voice. And there is this interesting continued undercurrent to his motivation being like a hatred and resentment over Rhaenyra. Like he cannot handle Rhaenyra being in charge. Or he specifically like says, there's no home for someone like me, not while Rhaenyra is on the throne, not while a Targaryen's on the throne. Like he still seems to be kind of targeting his ire at her.
It reminds me too of like this constant discussion that the show has of we've certainly talked a lot about in previous episodes about patriarchy and sexism, but how that intermingles with class in a very fascinating way of like, clearly Kristen Cole is correct in his feeling of like, oh, I don't have this sort of feathered bed to go back to that you all have. And also is correct in how Rhaenyra will probably go after him because of his role in all of this. But as we know from season one, part of his resentment is a level of sexism. Like she didn't want to be with me. And so it's that level of like resentment that some of these sort of ingrained patriarchal guys sort of get towards women. But then it tying into like, yeah, Rhaenyra is an upper class woman who has power over him as well. So those dynamics sort of intermingling in all of this too, that is really fascinating. But David, anything that you wanted to add to these sequences?
I think all the Kristen Cole stuff and Gwaine stuff is great. But I'm just going to say, not loving the whole mystical powers thing. Like, where the hell is any of this going? I hope that we don't find out in like an episode 7 or 8 with like reanimated corpse of Aemon shows up at the door and some stupid things happen. Like, you know, because the last we saw of him, she like Alice Rivers kind of made him pass out with some interesting powers, basically, right?
And I think he also passed out from a dagger wound.
Yeah, he got stabbed in like the kidney, it looked like a pretty gnarly stab wound. And yeah, it was like, help me. Yeah. And then I think we cut to black as she was like, overtaking his consciousness.
It didn't seem like a mortal wound to me. It did not seem like a mortal wound that he suffered. So then it's like, clearly she's exerting some other kind of powers on him. That was my interpretation.
Yeah.
And I guess she just cleaned the whole thing up by herself. Maybe. I don't know. I hope, like, this is, like, very mildly annoying to me, this whole subplot of what's going on with Alice Rivers, because they've been hinting at it for literally over 2 years now, and it would just be nice to have some answers there. Okay.
No, I
rest my case.
I agree with you. It's something that I'll save a little bit more for the bonus episode discussion, because it'll tie into some books knowledge that we have. But what I will say is it does clearly play into like the show trying to stall its wheels a little bit with Aemon, because like we need Aemon off the board so that he's not like screwing up the rest of the storyline we have with his dragon showing up. So it's a very much like, all right, we'll knock him out, shove him away with something off screen, and he'll come back up when he when we need him to for the plot to move forward. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was it's a bit of a frustrating, like, it was kind of similar thing with Damon last season with the Alice River stuff, where it's like, we need Damon to be stuck here for a while because we have other plot stuff that needs to happen, so we'll just spin our wheels with him doing mystical stuff until we need him. So
yeah, I also think, like, the magic, the specifics of, like, how magic works and how different people are able to wield it has always been really opaque in George R. R. Martin's world. And so I think the frustration that you're brushing up against too is that it's like, it sometimes feels like it's very convenient that we can just say that this character can do this because they have access to super magic powers things. So right, like, it what popped into my mind was, I was like, are they trying to set up that, like, Alice Rivers has, like, I don't know if glamour is a widespread term, but you know that, like, the idea that you can glamour something, like, disguise it from other people. So I was like, are we meant to believe that Alice has the ability to, like, make the castle look entirely empty and free of blood or evidence or a dragon, even though it isn't? That would be, like, some crazy massive super abilities that she has. Or are we just meant to be twiddling our thumbs a little bit while we wait to find out where Amand really is? I also, the last thing I want to say from this scene that really stood out to me was Kristen, again, in his sort of, like, this zeal of, like, no, like, we're gonna go about this my way, we're gonna fight man to man. He says, our fight will not be clean, but it will be pure. What did you think of that one?
I didn't buy it. I was like, that sounds like some really self-deceptive thing you say to convince yourself that you're not a bastard. You know, that's kind of what it struck me.
Yeah.
It won't be clean, but it'll be pure. Pure what? Pure being a terrible person, you know, like, anyway.
Yeah.
Right, sorry. Like, those are synonyms. And so to try to say that it won't be one, but it will be the other. It reminded me later in the episode, Ormond says something about the Targaryens where he says, like, they lack intelligence, but they possess cunning. And I'm like, well, which one is it? You know? So I think that these men seem to be cut from the same cloth of, like, having to live under a level of self-delusionment about their mission, their choices, their behaviors. And right, they're trying to justify it.
Yeah.
And it seems pretty unjustifiable in many cases.
Well, speaking of class stuff, let us talk quick about Hugh and Ulf. Both Hugh and Ulf ask for a private audience with Rhaenyra. First, Hugh requests being assigned to Tumbleton watch duty since he knows his wife and Kat and her family are living there, as we'll discuss later on. But then Ulf, after we get a quick scene of him going back and sort of being a hero in his tavern to all the people, who sort of like, hey, you moved on up, my guy. It's awesome to see you getting ahead in this world. He comes in to ask some favors from Rhaenyra. And when she turns him down, he gives a brutal piece of gossip that prompts Rhaenyra to send the gold cloaks hunting for traitors, because he sort of discusses this graffiti that he sees that says Queen of Bastards. And one thing I did note that I thought was really interesting as we talk about classism here, and that was discussed in the behind the scenes stuff, is that Ulf didn't know how to read. He doesn't know how to read. So he only knew that it said Queen of Bastards when he overheard other people saying it. So I like that little note there. But David, what do you think of this whole sequence with Ulf and Hugh?
You know, the journalist / podcaster Michael Hobbs once did a podcast about Princess Diana, and I listened to it. I think it was You're Wrong About. That was the podcast that he was doing at the time. And he made this case that being in the royal family is a human rights violation. The idea is that when you're a royal, you don't have self-determination. Mm-hmm. Like, people love to shit on the royals, and that's reasonable because they're wealthy beyond comprehension and they live lives of glamour. But they also have very limited choices in terms of what they're able to do and how they're able to live their lives. And I think a lot of Rhaenyra's blundering in these last few episodes can really be chalked up to, she just hasn't seen very much of the world. Like, she's making a lot of decisions that someone would make if they didn't understand human nature or hadn't seen much of the world, which she hasn't. Just because, you know, of the nature of her existence. And so it's unfortunate. that she doesn't understand, like, the life that she lives is very, very, very different than the life of a commoner or small folk. And it's basically unrecognizable to them. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see how painfully she's going to have to learn that lesson as the show goes on. But I think we see the start of it, or the beginnings of it, in these last few episodes.
Yeah, one thing that kind of struck me as very interesting, especially with Ulf's scene here, was how she didn't respect him in any regard of like, oh yeah, you coming in and ask me favors, like, screw you, like, do your job, get back in line, you're not to go and do these things. And you see the resentment that Ulf gets in these moments, and I really feel for Ulf a lot. Actually, I'm like fully on Ulf's side of like, you know, I'm giving my life to you, doing all these things, and I'm asking for some small things, and this should be an easy win for Rhaenyra to get him on her side of like, yeah, I'll do these small things for you, I'll save your friends, whatever. But her reaction is like, no, you're supposed to do what I want you to do. And it's this sense of superiority and again hierarchy that she has over him, that she doesn't see him as a human being that she needs to give like respect to. And I think that's like, you see that like hurt that Ulf has of like, he sees Rhaenyra as a human, I think. And like, he actually mm-hmm. humanizes her, and sort of, while he understands that she's his queen, he does see her as a person that he can kind of talk to, and she doesn't respond to that in kind. Mm-hmm. And I love his response of, and I love the way the actor plays this, of he sort of is like, well, I've heard that they call you Queen of Bastards, but I don't put any stock of that, but they say that. And he's honestly kind of saying it kindly of like, yeah, I hear this, and they're saying that because they think you're an unkind leader. And he's saying like, you're being unkind to me without so much saying it. And he's saying it in a way that he can kind of get away with it. And it's actually very smart. Yeah. And Rhaenyra's reaction to that isn't like, oh, I've been unkind to Ulf. It's to, I need to crack down even harder on the right. small folk. And it again speaks to that sort of ingrained, like, I need to put my own self and my own reputation above anything else that, you know, is going to continually is biting her in the ass in all of these storylines and all of the mistakes that she makes, and about her reputation, even with like Corlys Velaryon and his kids as well. So all of that stuff I found to be super fascinating in those regards. But Kim, anything else you want to add to all of this?
No, I agree entirely. And I think that you can see how Rhaenyra is still kind of operating in survival mode, or like in like a fog of, what was it that she said last episode? I am awash in dilemmas and deficiencies. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, that hasn't changed for her, even though things feel a little more calm. And again, part of that's the directing of this episode, that we're not fully in her perspective. We still get little hints of it throughout this episode, though, of her being unsettled, of, you know, the sound going a little bit mute around her. And yeah, I think she seemed most rattled in this moment after Ulf drops this information that, you know, that people, and I think he kind of accidentally embellishes it a little more, mm-hmm. which I find interesting. Because again, when we look back at that, the scene where he overheard someone explaining the graffiti, the guy saying that even said, yeah, but that's just some, like, you know, resentful Hightowers who have already lost a war. Like, in fact, the on the ground information he thinks he's giving her might not be accurate, but she is.
Yeah,
or as pertinent, but she is so sensitive in this moment to any threat to her legitimacy that she reacts incredibly strongly. And I think, yeah, makes the mistake of sending the gold cloaks. You know, when you watch it, she doesn't say, like, go bring me their heads, or go, you know, go shut down all of those people. But I think it's an example of her, A, not realizing the gold cloaks' true methods of rooting out things like this, again, because she's been sheltered and hasn't seen as much up close day-to-day life, I would say, in both Fleabottom and the rest of King's Landing. It absolutely feels like a blunder, and I thought that the scene was really beautifully staged to give us the emotional reasoning behind that, both for Ulf and for Rhaenyra in this little mini confrontation.
Yeah. Well, moving on, we have a really interesting sequence where Daemon arrives in the Vale and speaks with Lady Jane Arryn about her allegiance and debt to Queen Rhaenyra. Also, just want a quick note, this was in the behind the scenes, they rebuilt the Eerie set from Game of Thrones season one for this sequence, completely rebuilt it from the ground up and get the moon door and all of that fun stuff there. So that was really cool to see. But Jane scoffs at the implication she owes anything further, but agrees to send gold for the royal treasury. As Daemon goes to fly back to King's Landing, his dragon Craxes instead careens off to a mountain cave and reveals Rhaena hiding with Sheepstealer. The father-daughter reunion is tense, cathartic, and painful for both parties. They part under the presumption that Rhaenyra will live in exile for the rest of her life, while Daemon will keep her secret by as we see later on, brutally killing a sheep herder he sees and then dropping the head right in front of Rhaenyra at the small council, which sort of sets Rhaenyra off. But Kim, what did you think of this whole sequence?
I love seeing Daemon in this different element. I think the last time we saw him in the Vale was when he killed his wife. And this whole season, you are really seeing the way that Daemon has like grown and changed, and I think become much more politically savvy in some ways. And then in other ways, much more like soft and tender and emotional, and just the way that Matt Smith played Daemon's affect entirely changing when he realized that it was Rhaena who was there with Sheepstealer. Also interesting that Daemon didn't even seem that intent on looking for Sheepstealer. Like,
he had
told Rhaenyra that that would be his priority, but as soon as he had the gold, he was like, come on, Caraxes, we're going back. I'm really getting the impression from Daemon this season that like he has changed for the better in so many ways. He often has I think pretty solid schemes or solid intuitions, but it's like, it's all too late, you know, like it's too late for him to suddenly bond with Rhaena and make her feel more important to him. Like she's already gone to the most extreme she could have to try to gain his attention and his favor. He might try to be showing up for Rhaenyra and being a proper king consort to her. But again, he's so far down the line of his own ambitions that they're getting out from under him. And this was a good example of that. Again, incredible dragon moments throughout this entire sequence. I loved Caraxes, like all of the movements and the sort of like frenetic energy you could tell was coming off of him that like very much reminded me of like a dog scenting another dog in the area or being like, hey, someone we know is over there. We gotta go check it out. Just really, really cool. What about you?
Shows again, the dragons have their own personalities and can't always be controlled even by like a seasoned dragon rider by Daemon, which was very interesting to see. Yeah, I loved this sequence. I loved Daemon getting a chance to, you know, show off like that he has grown with his kid. I also love the visual of when Rhaena steps out of the cave and we get that visual of her standing in front of the fire. It was a really cool visual to see. And then all the stuff with Rhaenyra in the council where he's trying to play off like, oh yeah, you would it really have helped you to get justice for this guy? And he's both like playing up his own like, oh, I'm trying to hide that I didn't really catch this guy, but also like trying to be supportive of Rhaenyra of like, you wouldn't really have wanted this. And it's like trying to be supportive of her, but also hiding his own complicity and hiding things and trying to protect his own daughter. And these sort of dual loyalties, I think, was very, very fascinating, as he brings up. But David, anything to add to this whole like Daemon arc in this episode?
The only thing I have to say is, isn't this the second time on the show we've seen Daemon kill a random innocent?
Yes.
to cover something else up, right? Mm-hmm. I guess it worked the first time. Like, there was no issues. It went off without a hitch the first time.
Yeah.
So why would he be discouraged? But
he's
almost like a serial killer in a way, right? Like he's randomly just sniping people for his own ends, but kind of sucks to be perceived by Daemon Targaryen in any way.
I know. At first I thought, I was like, oh man, that guy's in trouble because he just heard a very sensitive conversation. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I just thought, just on the merits alone of Daemon thinking that you know, that this big secret might be out there, who would be toast. And then I was like, oh no, Daemon also just really went there. Yeah, the way in which different characters in this episode, but in this world altogether, treat the sanctity of human life matters, And like, it matters that Damon is the kind of person who no longer cares for any one individual life aside from those in his immediate family. Mm-hmm. And Ormond, I think, is similar, as we see by the end of this episode, that yeah. to him, he is above needing to truly be connected with the devastation that a murder brings.
I did like that Missaria, it sort of clocks that Damon's lying, and it does sort of speak to the short-sightedness of Damon as well, too, of the fact that he thinks this will go off just fine, but it's like, just Sheep Stealer needs to get seen with another writer again, which seems like might happen, and all of this falls apart. So yeah, I think it just speaks to the short-sighted nature of Damon. Like, it reads good in character, like you would think that way, of like, I'll just murder a guy and it'll solve all my problems.
I also like, it was really believable to me, the entire exchange he was having of like trying to find a way out of this situation. Yes. Of being like, if you go back now, like just go right. to Pentos now. You know, like I fully believed Damon was trying to undo the tragedy and figured his sort of best way out, but I really don't think that there was a best way out of that scenario. Yeah. Short of Rhaena truly taking accountability for what she had done, but I also understand Rhaena not trusting that her admission would be received well. So
a couple quick little things that still happen in King's Landing here. We have Rhaenyra returns Otto's ring to Alicent and confirms she sent his body to Old Town, once again seeming to strive for connection. And then when they're alone together, Alicent appears to realize that Helaena has a growing pregnancy, which is certainly going to be a complicated thing for everything going on there. And then we have a quick little scene, too, that we already alluded to, but just to mention it, is Rhaenyra quick goes and sees Orwyle, and they talk about sort of the connection of the Faith to the High Towers. And while the Faith has a lot of connection to the High Towers, they certainly have their own sort of belief system that is sort of separate from that. And she should be worried about pushing too hard against the Faith, because it might push people against her. And also we sort of learned that there wasn't a lot of conversation back from Ormond to folks in the Red Keep. Anything about these little quick developments here? I do love that Orwyle gets a little bloodthirsty, and Allison's like, I respect that you're getting a little bloodthirsty here. But other than that, anything else here? All right. Well, then the last section of our discussion is going to be basically all dealing with everything going on in Tumbleton and with Ormond Hightower and Darren. So back in Tumbleton, Kat returns to her brother's house with groceries. The senior-most soldiers start molesting her in plain view of everybody, and a fight breaks out, basically, as you said, Chekhov's rape scene, which was great. I say sarcastically. Kat's sister-in-law shoves the soldier off. He breaks her arm, and then Kat's brother then hits the soldier, and everything spirals. Somehow Kat's family gets the footleys involved, and the matter is brought before Ormond, who sort of does the will punish the soldier and, I believe, the people. And it seems to, again, be a fair ruler that he is trying to be and trying to teach Darren to be, as we get him sort of offhandedly sort of talking to Darren and giving him advice here. Any thoughts on this, David?
Well, I'm just going to say, you got me again, Game of Thrones, right? Because I thought to myself, oh, he's going to rule in favor of the soldier. And then he doesn't. And he orders the soldier gelded. And the soldier's like, I have a wife. And I'm like, you should have thought of that before you tried to do it. And so I'm thinking to myself, wow, actually a good thing happened in this show. And then, of course, nope. By the end of the episode, it's basically undone. I'm like, did the soldier even get punished? You know, I don't even know. Yeah, and even though it's happened like 85 times where I'm thinking, oh, well, you know, maybe something good will happen. Nope. I still was like, maybe something good happened. And then they got me again. You still got it. You still got it, House of the Dragon. That's my reaction.
Yeah. So Kim, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, same, but I guess more pissed off.
yeah.
Like, yeah, on the one hand, I fully understand that this just is the show that we're watching, that apparently within this universe, if you want to watch these stories unfold, you should be prepared to watch what I think is disproportionate amount of sexual assault happen on screen. Mm-hmm. I guess disproportionate to what? Just unnecessary, I suppose. And not to say that I don't think that, like, the subject of assault can't be discussed, but I think, like, for me, I continue to come back to just feeling like I do not need to see the details from multiple angles of hands being put on bodies, of awful sounds being put into my ears. And then, yeah, the salt in the wound of it was, like, I honestly, like, when they cut off the actual altercation scene with Kat's brother being hit over the head. And I was shocked to realize that they were bringing all of those characters in front of Ormond for some sort of, like, flash trial. Like,
right.
It was like my stomach literally dropped again because I was like, there's no way that this is going to end well for these people. Like, I didn't believe it. And even the resolution as it was happening in that moment, yeah, felt too good to be true.
And yeah, obviously it turns out to be. Yeah.
And I'm really struggling with that choice to put, like, such a clear just, like, corruption and abuse and, like, death and devastation thing again front and center. This is the three out of four episodes of this season
have had a sexual assault. Yeah, this is something that I know we've touched on before, so I don't want to go too deep into it, but it is something that I struggle with, because certainly I think it is worth discussing, especially in a show about, like, sexism, patriarchy, as we've discussed before, to talk about sexual assault. It's a very real thing that happens, a real thing that happened a lot, especially in past times, certainly happens a lot today still too as well, and worth discussing. But sometimes I do feel like, even going back to the original Game of Thrones with characters like Sansa and the cruelty inflicted upon her as a character, that sometimes the show revels, this universe revels a bit too much in the spectacleizing of these scenes. I think the worst one for me was the treatment of Alicent, I think two episodes ago, which it felt like an unnecessary scene that wasn't in the books, was just added to sort of, like, make us hate this Iron Rod character even more. And really feels like just like, oh, we got to really dig in the knife to make to show how cruel this world is. And it feels a bit unnecessary and a bit spectacleizing of these elements, especially when they're kind of used frivolously, like in the first episode of the show, this season, I should say, where we had the officer under Kristen Cole doing a sexual assault. And here again, it's another version of that, and of like, oh, we're going to use it to dig a knife. And it's certainly used for a bit more plot discussions here, but it is like, we're going to have these very spectacleized versions of sexual assault all to give character to other people, like the men involved, like Ormond, and their ways of viewing these things and dealing with these things, without really any empathy too much towards the women characters that they use these scenes for. It's just used for other men involved, and then even more cruelty inflicted upon the people that that face these sexual assaults. So it's a difficult thing that I always struggle with, because it's like, again, I think sexual assault should and can be discussed, and certainly isn't something that should be avoided being depicted. But I think there are ways to do it that don't over spectacleize, overemphasize. And I think the show sometimes falls on the wrong side of that line for me. So, yeah. Well, moving on, a scene that I liked a lot better that showcases, like, abuse dynamics was, we have Ormond gets a raven from Gawain, after all, apparently telling him Aemond isn't coming to Tumbleton. The High Lord flips his lip, hacking a sword at the table for coming, returning to his smelling pots, again, is like prissy nature. And one thing that I did like about this that I just want to mention is I loved the bit with Darren where he sees that this reaction is about to happen. And he says to the servant, like, get out of here. Go, but he kind of does it in a subtle way of like, just get out, just go now. And I thought it was very good, and it again speaks to Ormond and his lack of temper control, because he is this high-born guy and the repression, as I spoke about before, but also again shows like Darren is used to this, and it showcases an abusive emotional dynamic where, like, Ormond seems to be teaching him and guiding him and giving this advice as a leader, as we see throughout this episode. But Darren's reaction here showcases that he has been party to these outbursts before, and it is such a normalized thing. that he just like, yep, just do it. And he just handles it and goes through. And that is, especially for a kid having to regulate the emotions of a father figure, mm-hmm. speaks to a lot of abuse that then gets portrayed even more overtly at the end of the episode. Mm-hmm. So I really thought that was actually a very nuanced look at abusive relationships and parental relationships in the show. But Kim, any thoughts on this sequence?
Yeah, I thought that was genius. I thought it was really well done to show us the way that Daron has had to become hypervigilant around mm-hmm. Ormond. And especially in contrast with what we see Alicent, like her hopes for him.
Yeah.
We can see very clearly that this was not necessarily a better environment.
One version of abuse for trade, one version of abuse for another version of abuse, it feels like, yeah.
Exactly. And like, yes, I think that they did a really great job of showing just how observant Daron is and how smart he is, how caring he is compared to the other people in the room. Because again, like his reason for sending out the other servant was to save them. Like this, the move made me think that Ormond has killed someone before in a rage, and that Daron is trying to clear the room for everyone's safety, and he himself even backs away, you know, like Daron throws something like that, or Ormond throws something. Like you can see that he's probably been hit or hurt before, or watched other people be hurt by Ormond multiple times. And add to that the way that Daron calls him sire throughout this episode, I thought was also really interesting, distinct from how most lords get referred to as my lord. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was, again, trying to reinforce for us that Daron really does see Ormond as his only father figure, let alone like his only parental figure, because we know Alicent has not been able to be around. And it's really just sad. Like my heart was really so quickly with Daron throughout this episode, and me being like, oh no, here's another child I need to feel deeply protective over, or just, you know, I'm watching them get put through the ringer of these really poisonous dynamics.
Yeah.
So it was a really great scene.
With a lot
and of I was like, are those just scenting herbs or stones or something? I also got the sense that there is more of a drug in these little sniffing pots than Ormond is maybe letting on, and that the smelling sensitivity is like a cover for him regulating himself. He's doing some self-medicating, it seems like, in Westeros.
Well, I'm kind of curious what you all make of the introduction of Ormond as a character, really, in this episode. I mean, we've seen him in multiple other episodes. I'm not saying this is the first time he's appeared, but to me, this is a pretty cool character. Now, like, because it's hard, they're basically introducing an entire other player into this dynamic that, like, heretofore was just like a hench person. Like, we thought, like, I didn't think they were actually a chess piece on the actual board. Controlling a chess piece on the actual board. I thought they were just like some guy that someone else told what to do. And I have to say, overall, I think this is a pretty effective introduction of this character. Like, I think it's like, hey, this is a guy who has some interesting characteristics to it, characteristics to him, and is somewhat complicated. He's not just completely evil. He has a code. And even though it's really messed up and will result in killing and torturing people, probably, like, he's trying to adhere to that code. So I thought this is a pretty good character introduction. You guys already know Ormond as a character. So, like, what do you think of how this show introduced the character of Ormond?
Well, we'll talk about it in our bonus episode, because he doesn't have as much characterization in the book, if I recall. Kim can correct me on that. So I actually think they did a really good job fleshing him out, especially as we'll talk about it in a second, the final scene that we get in this episode, which I can jump into here. But I really did like this very complicated view we get of him, because, again, prissy nature, he's sort of like, but he seems to be firm but fair, trying to be a good father figure. But then we get these little hints of like cruelty with Gwaine, and then his very unregulated emotions that we sort of get here, and how that abuses Daron. And then at the end, this reveal when he has, so I'll talk about it in a second, Daron kill a guy in secret. And it's sort of the sense of, again, superiority. We're better than other people. And so it's like, I know how to play the political game of like looking good to the lowborns and in front of people who like I need to look good of in front of. But also I will reveal my hand and be like, I think we're superior. High towers are the best. We are even more like ordained by the faith in some way. And it again, speaks to this sort of like very conservative mindset. I think lowercase c conservative in terms of not like our political dynamics today, but the sense of like, we're the status quo. We're the people who deserve this. We're ingrained in like the fabric of this world and country in ways that the Targaryens themselves are not, as these sort of invaders coming in, as he sort of alludes to. And I think that's it paints a very complicated, but very self-important and undisciplined in terms of like understanding his highborn place, but in terms of undisciplined, in terms of being a mature adult and leader, I think in a very fascinating way. I think it's he's a realistic and very complicated character that we get displayed in one episode, especially in his relationship with Darren.
I totally agree that, yeah, Ormond is one of the players in this section of Fire and Blood that doesn't get a ton of like detailed characterization, not a lot of one-on-one conversation exchanges. So this entire episode did feel to me like really kind of blowing open a new avenue of the story here in a way that I'm really excited to see play out more, and that I definitely kind of underestimated. Like when I heard that, like, yeah, Daron's coming, yeah, oh, we've cast Ormond, I was like, cool. But right, I didn't have very high expectations for gaining any sort of attachment to these characters. And I think that in this one episode, for them to have really crystallized who these people are in a way that feels very believable and rich was phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, just to kind of touch upon that, to cover in our recap here, in the final scene of the episode, Hugh and Vermithor arrive to stand watch outside of Tumbleton, but he doesn't realize the horror already unfolding within. Ormond has secretly had Cat's brother arrested and brought to the town sept. Going back on his public word, Ormond orders Darren to kill the smith as punishment for striking one of the Hightower soldiers. The young prince carries out the execution reluctantly, horrified by Ormond's newly revealed scheme to crown Darren as king in Aegon and Aemon's absence. And I think even specifically too, saying you are basically a Hightower in all but name. So this is a Hightower victory, not necessarily a Targaryen victory, mm-hmm. which is a fascinating element there. But Kim, you want to talk about this last little sequence here?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, even just the drama of them staging this in the sept, like the symbolism of Ormond, like really trying to embody this church space as like, as if that makes this entire unfolding chain of events, like, again, more clean or pure. Like, I'm like, oh, Kristen would love this guy. They really need to just team up. but I thought that seeing Daron again, like opening this shot with him sort of like closely nuzzling his dragon as if it's like a dog or a pet, you kind of get mm-hmm. the sense that Tessarion is like a silver lining for Daron throughout all of this scenario. He does seem to really carry the weight of his position well. That's another thing I haven't mentioned yet as we've been talking about him, is like the physicality that the actor brings to Daron, how he's mm-hmm. always like very stiff-backed, arms behind his back. In a
very
way
good
that
young actor for this role. Yeah.
So good. Like really, really great. And yeah, the way that Ormond kind of immediately comes in hot and is like, I've told you not to be all sentimental with those beasts. Like, you get the sense that Ormond from birth has been really trying to separate Daron from his Targaryen identity, but also clearly that's not working very well. Daron seems very much bonded to Tessarion in this little glimpse that we get of him. And yeah, I really believed Daron's horror at finding out that his father figure had no intention of being a good, loyal lord to the crown, but in fact had like these usurping tendencies. And also, I think that this is, it's so cool that within one episode, we can kind of both understand Daron and Ormond's dynamic and see it break.
Yeah.
Same time. Like, I feel like we somehow saw Daron get the full disillusionment right now of who his father figure really is. and what schemes are truly afoot. And it's like, oh, up until this point, he was on board. Like, he had drunk the Kool-Aid. He was in on it. He really believed in the mission. And yeah, this scene really made it seem as though that all just became a lot more tenuous and fracturable, because Darren seems to have the good-heartedness to see that what he's being asked to do is wrong. And then he does it anyways, which was like, yeah, just again, this is the world that we're in, isn't it?
Like, it is. It's something I've been writing about. I've been working on a piece for my own channel about abuser dynamics. And one of the things that often happens with abusers is they make you complicit in their abuse. And so like this is Ormond forcing Darren to kill another man, even though against his will. And now he's complicit in this act. And sort of like Darren now is more just by seeming accountability, more seemingly having to be bought in on what Ormond wants to do. And that's part of his abuse dynamic of like, I'm going to make you do what I want you to do by making you feel like you are complicit in my violence. And that certainly is what plays out here. And it's a very, again, common abuse tactic. And the way they portray Ormond as an abuser in this episode, I think, is very nuanced and very thoughtful, and how it ties into the larger political machinations as well, and the sense of superiority with his character, I think, is really well thought out. But David, any thoughts on this final sequence?
That was beautifully said, and I don't know that I can add that. It's a very effective introduction, and I'm very curious just how prominent this character's role is going to be going forward.
He's a very fascinating display of this character that we got this episode. But that does mean we have officially reached the end of the episode, so I just want to hand it over to you two. Do you two have any final thoughts on this? David, any final thoughts on the episode overall?
No, I would say that, well, yes, a couple.
No, but not yes. Yes, I do.
not no. But I would say that this is, like I said, I would say this is a fairly standard episode of the show, and still very good. I'd probably give it like an 8 out of 10 or something like that. But I think, you know, if the first three episodes had some like mind blowing, wow, I can't believe that happened on the show moments. This episode was still just very good. It's like very solid, but not like to the heights of those episodes, I would say. But still had a great time and loved hearing you two share your insights about it.
Yeah. Kim, any final thoughts?
Really, that this episode made me really excited to go back and rewatch, I would say, like the last 8 episodes all in succession. Like, I have yet to do that since season 3 has been premiering here. But as David was talking about at the top of our show, I think that once we can experience like the momentum of this story going through like the final 2 episodes of last season into these 4, it's like just a phenomenal run of television is what it's feeling like to me.
And I agree with you both on this. This was a really solid episode, not 10 out of 10, but I think it speaks to the high quality of the rest of the episodes, not the anything to do with this episode's quality, that this one sort of stands out against those two is a little bit lesser, but still very, very good. And again, portrays as a very complicated, nuanced villain, while also, I think, deepening some of our other characters' ingrained issues, problems, and pathos, as we've got with like Rhaenyra and other characters. So again, very, very solid. Well, that does officially bring us to the end of this episode, but don't forget to be on the lookout for our bonus episode later this week that'll be available for folks on decodingtv.com. So please, again, consider supporting over there if you want to get that and ad-free episodes of the show. And again, if you want to give us feedback or have any of your thoughts possibly read out on the show, please consider emailing us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Even if your email does not get read, we really enjoy getting your emails as well. All 3 of us, I know, take a look at all of them that we get sent our way. So it's really, really cool to hear all of your thoughts, and we appreciate it.
I just want to also, before we end the official episode, say it was so nice to have David Chen back with us.
Well, it's nice to be back.
You know, Cast of Kings is your baby, and in many ways you have shared it beautifully with us and the rest of the world, and so it's nice to have you back and talking about this season with us.
I feel the same way, but also just feel so thrilled with what both of you are doing with the show. And sometimes if you love something, you have to set it free. you know, and that's what I've tried to do with the podcast. So I appreciate the insights that you both are bringing and the hard work that you're bringing to maintaining the show. So thank you both.
Thank you. I do really appreciate you. Like, it has been an honor to, and like truly an honor that you have trusted us both to run this podcast without you being here while you've been dealing with so many other life things. It means a lot to both of us, I'm sure, and means a lot to me. Thank you so much. And I hope everyone else has been enjoying it. And we're so glad to have you back. And hopefully we'll have you back for a few more episodes throughout the season as well.
Yeah, one or two more episodes through the season. I'll try to make it happen. So
perfect. Yeah. Awesome. Well, last few things to say, too. Again, if you want to see David Chen's wonderful, amazing face, because we've all missed him very much, you can check that out over at youtube.com/decodingTV. Please go subscribe over there for that. But with all of that said, thank you much for joining us, and we will see you for our discussion next week of season 3, episode 5 of House of the Dragon.